Dr. Chris Johnson is somebody I've known for a while, just kind of casually because of who he worked with and the people that were in his life. But he has reached the level of chief executive officer for the Rape and Abuse Crisis Center here in Fargo-Moorhead. And we were talking on the phone the other day, and some of what he told me made me ask him to come in and speak about it. It's the type of things that nobody wants to speak about, but everybody needs to hear. And so I want to visit with him. Dr. Johnson, good to have you on News and Views.
Thank you so much, Joel.
You're going to tell me just use Chris, so I'll do that.
Yeah, I am.
So how you been?
Good.
Your line of work is just, it's amazing the dedication you and others have to this. It's got to be exhausting by the time you get home.
You know, our frontline staff are really the heroes of the story. You know, those are the folks who are meeting victims where they're at, are seeing the horrific aftermath of violence, stepping in on behalf of children for their welfare. So I'm just excited to be a part of it, but I have to give all the credit to our frontline staff. They do just amazing work.
Okay, so you are head of the Rape and Abuse Crisis Center here,
but
describe the structure.
Yep.
Of statewide.
Yep.
You're going to hear some different names, ladies and gentlemen, but describe the organization and how it structures together.
Yeah, thank you, Joel. On the North Dakota side, because we're Rape and Abuse Crisis Center of Fargo-Moorhead, so we're recognized by Minnesota and North Dakota. So on the North Dakota side, there are 20 crisis centers that are domestic violence, sexual assault providers across the state. So we consider ourselves sister agencies, but we're private nonprofits. We do have a coalition organization, which is a 501c3 that is Cause of North Dakota. And that really coordinates the efforts of all the sister agencies across the state. But we're each independent private nonprofits, but recognize that we have to have a really strong network if we're going to adequately serve victims across the state. Now, on the Minnesota side, there's 193 sister agencies. And so very, very similar over there. However, the coalitions are broken out between domestic violence and sexual assault on the Minnesota side.
Okay. Now, part of the things that jumps out at me, you know, and we'll get to the need and we'll get to what you see happening out there. But I want to focus on the structure if I can. Right now, you're being listened to by a lot of Western North Dakota, Eastern Montana.
Yep.
Okay. I mean, Key 660 is one of those, you know, heritage radio stations. Do you have the type of, I don't want to say protection, but support all over the state? Because many times you hear that you can't find the folks you need sometimes in Western North Dakota.
It's a really, really good question. And, you know, our sister agencies that are on the west side or maybe in more of the rural areas struggle. You know, they might have one or two employees and they might cover four or five counties. And so and they're usually a one woman show. You know, they're writing their own grants, they're reporting, they're seeing clients, they're keeping a facility operating. And so when you get into the rural areas, yes, we do have coverage and we have services, but they're not going to look similar to the ones in the more metro areas of the state.
Okay.
But yes, the entire state is blanketed with agencies that cover these issues.
Well, and the reason I ask these questions, you know, Chris, is because of the fact that the need's there.
Yeah.
And that's what prompted me to say, hey, would you mind coming in, sitting here and speaking about it? Because the way you described it, it's not getting better out
there. No, it's not. It's not. And we're seeing, you know, one of the, and I don't know if this is healthy or not, but one of my kind of daily routines is I get up and immediately pull up the headlines and just do a quick count. You know, if there's 15 headlines, how many of those headlines are what we would consider our issues? So, you know, domestic violence, sexual assault, child sexual abuse. And it's usually a third, you know, give or take. And that's what drives me. You know, we're not winning. We don't have our arms around this problem. It still continues to rage out of control. And we're better than that. You know, we're better people than that. And so just really looking at what are the intervention techniques, but also what are the primary prevention techniques that we can implement into communities that curb violence before it begins.
See, and what I think happens, and I don't know if I'm basing this off experience or what I'm basing it off of, in terms of some people I know, is I think people just ignore it. Even if they assume it, they ignore it. And it's just so frustrating. You know, before there were organizations like you, you know, when bad things were happening, oftentimes people in congregations or people that had friends of friends, I can tell you this, there were people that came to our home and spent time with us that were in bad situations.
Yes.
Because that's who my mother was and what she did. You know, to have an organization like yours now, to be able to rely on or at least say, hey, look, you've got to reach out to them. That's just, That's so valuable.
It is. It is. It's you know, the rape crisis center movement, which is a real thing. You know, so if you Googled that, just rape crisis centers, you'll see across the country there was a this huge spring up of rape crisis centers in every state in the late 70s. And you're right, Joel. Before that, we had more of like an informal network of family and churches and community members. And, you know, these issues are incredibly difficult when you have professional services wrapped around them. I can't imagine what it looked like without services wrapped around them. I mean, talk about putting everyone in danger. Of course, these were good people doing good things, but we know that domestic violence situations are probably some of the most violent that law enforcement responds to. And so it's a difficult situation.
What about domestic violence? What about, you know, the type of things that I think society used to just look away from and used to say, well, you know, she's in a bad marriage or she married him or that type of an attitude.
Right. Yeah. You know, that is kind of the outdated thinking, right? That, well, that's their problem. They'll figure it out. It's not my business, whatever it might be. But we all want a healthy community. We all want our neighbors to be healthy. And so, you know, even if something by societal definition doesn't rise to violence, you know, we still see that power and control exist in relationships. You know, if you are in a relationship and your partner does not make your flame burn brighter, that's your first question. Like, what is this person doing for me? And oftentimes what we see in domestic violence or very controlling relationships is there's a desire to kind of snuff out your partner's flame. And if that's some of the dynamic, then we really encourage people to step back and evaluate that relationship.
So let's do a scenario.
Yeah.
I know there's a problem. I sense there's a problem. I reach out to the individuals. Let's use the typical. She looks at me definitely in fear of being able to tell me because of the price she'll pay at home. Yeah. What do I do?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a question that so many people have because we want to do the right thing, right? I think if we are in a situation where we're overhearing domestic violence or even have an indication that there's probably violence going on, I think calling law enforcement is never a bad idea. You know, getting law enforcement involved early is not a bad idea. Law enforcement will come in, they'll assess the situation. Law enforcement, anytime they're responding to domestic violence, make sure that everyone in the home has rape and abuse crisis centers information. Like, that's kind of the first step, you know, and so I understand that people are hesitant to call law enforcement because we think that's going to lead to an arrest. Whereas if this is the first time we're coming across this, law enforcement might not make an arrest. They might just go in and just kind of evaluate the situation and say, hey, folks, here's some resources. I think when we start intervening on our own, things can get really, really scary. And so if I kind of have this if I kind of have this, like, I can solve the problem.
Okay.
Vigilante.
Yep.
You know, if I'm going to play vigilante, I put everyone at risk, you know, because it just doesn't have the proper safeguard of law enforcement and the formal structure. So now I'm just kind of inserting myself into an already violent situation. And so.
And the minute you leave, she could be at way more.
Exactly.
Risk
I could
you,
do way more right. damage than right. good, even though I think I'm doing good. And so I think recognizing how volatile domestic violence is, and recognizing that we have formal systems in place and that is usually the best option is to get others involved.
Okay, so let's take that a step farther when we come back. Let's talk a little bit about what you're seeing numbers-wise when it either goes ignored or you don't catch it in time or what's happening out there. Because I know some of what you've told me. I want them to know.
Yeah,
I want them to hear. We're visiting with Dr. Chris Johnson, Chief Executive Officer of the Rape and Abuse Crisis Center. And we're talking, and I'm not asking for numbers. I'm not trying to say, hey, what percentage this or that. I'm just looking for generalities, Chris. Mm-hmm. In terms of what's happening out there with, let's focus on wives if we can.
Yeah.
You know, has it gotten worse to the point where there's deaths? I mean, walk me through this.
Yeah. So before the pandemic really hit, it was pretty consistent. We saw about 3,000 people a year, 500 of those were children. And of course, our mission is domestic violence, sexual assault, and child sexual abuse. And so when the pandemic really came in and society shut down, per se, we saw a 20% decrease in the amount of people reaching out, which to us made complete sense. It was, you know, people are sheltering in place with their abuser. Like now is not the time to reach out. People know that the system is compromised. You know, law enforcement wasn't working in the same capacity. I mean, was just a really weird time. And so for those 2 years, we felt like we weren't really seeing the problem in its full scope because everyone was so hidden.
Right.
Well, as soon as things...
It makes total sense.
Doesn't it? And as soon as things started to open up, then we started to see this incredibly escalated aspect of violence. And so not to normalize domestic violence by any means, but, you know, the agency has been doing this for 45 years. And so there's some themes. There's some things that we understand that look like kind of traditional domestic violence. And what the staff recognized right away is... this is not what we're used to seeing. This is on a different level. This looks more like punishment. This is a little bit more sadistic. This is the lethality is through the roof. So every person who comes in for a DV, for DV services, gets a lethality assessment where we look at, you know, what are all the different things.
What does that mean?
Yeah. So these are things that based on like 40, 50 years of research, we know there's certain things that heighten the lethality of a domestic violence situation. So one would be, is there guns in the home? Okay. You know, so if a client who is coming in for domestic violence services indicates that yes, there is guns in the home, that increases the lethality. Now we're not saying,
what is the word lethality?
Yeah, like death. You know, so okay. right. So
so we're talking lethal. We're talking okay.
Right. Like so that is fortunately or unfortunately, that's our business, okay. Right? So we look at the lethality. That's number one.
Gotcha.
And so we have seen an elevated sense of lethality amongst all people coming in. So it is a disturbing trend that what the pandemic left us is a little bit more severe violence. And so there's lots of things.
And it became acceptable.
Right. Well, and there's lots of things that contribute. You know, people lost their jobs. People felt isolated. Mental health, you know, skyrocketed mental health needs. We saw our veterans who suffer from PTSD really struggle during the pandemic. Like all of us struggled. And so if we had a situation where there was already violence, that violence increased.
Okay.
And so that's what we're seeing. We're seeing far greater rates of violence. You know, Joel, you and I had talked last week about the term femicide, which is when a female is killed by her abusive partner. The rate of femicide, not only in the Fargo-Moorhead area, but also across the states of North Dakota and Minnesota has grown tremendously. We're seeing that. So it's just it's a scary time for the industry. It's a scary time for victims.
I everything, I guess, makes sense based upon what you just described because of the pandemic and how that all played out. I would guess for many of these women, the best part of their day was either going to work or when their spouse went to work, and that wasn't happening.
Yeah.
You know, so I can't imagine what their life must have been like.
Absolutely. The other factor that we saw is, you know, the schools, we're in every single public school. And so the schools, when you look at our kid data and you spread ages out across a normal curve, what you'll see is a spike at age 5. And so we see at age 5, we see much more 5-year-olds come in for sexual abuse services. Well, it's not because 5-year-olds are being abused more. It's because that's their first interaction with the formal system that was able to identify child sexual abuse in the home. So when we went remote and all learning was virtual, you took that away from teachers. Now, they have a really hard time identifying red flags in the home because every kid is now just on a screen. And so we saw our kid numbers get cut in half during the pandemic, and that was almost sickening to us because you know exactly what's going on, and we just don't have access to those kids like we had in the past. And
it change when they came back?
You know, it's... you know, it's we're seeing we talked a little bit about the shadow pandemic, and this is kind of the aftermath. And we're going to see this. Society has some issues that were kind of tabled during the pandemic, and rightfully so. You know, we were focusing on the overall public health, but we saw, you know, we're going to see blip in the data across the board. We're going to see heightened suicides. We're going to see heightened deaths occurring of domestic violence. We're going to see higher rates of sexual assault. We see higher rates of violent crime. I mean, these are all consequences of a system that was relatively lethargic to these issues.
So, you know, there's another reason right there, ladies and gentlemen, to thank your local teacher. I mean, imagine that, you know, that they have to be the first line of defense for that child when it comes. They're not just sitting there trying to teach them to read. Right. They're sitting there saying, wait a second, my radar's up here. Yeah. Something's happening to this little guy or little girl.
The amount of things that we ask of teachers is incredible. So I echo what you said, Joel. Thank a teacher.
So you know, let me ask this. The sheer, you know, the interaction. I mean, I don't know that I have the radar for what you do. I'm in fact, I know I don't. How, if you're the general public, do you deal with, and I realize calling law enforcement, we talked about that, but how do you notice?
Yeah.
How do you, see what I'm getting at?
I do.
So
I do.
Stick around. I want to ask, okay. Do you have a little more time?
I do.
Chris Johnson, ladies and gentlemen, he is Chief Executive Officer of the Rape and Abuse Crisis Center. If you have a question for him, go ahead and call 1-800-880-5346 or text us at 35270. We're talking about domestic violence. We're talking about rape and abuse today. Dr. Chris Johnson, Chief Executive Officer of the Rape and Abuse Crisis Center here in the Fargo-Moorhead area, which is part of a network that goes, in the area that's listening to me right now. It's in your backyard as well. That may not be Chris's area. There is someone out there if you need this type of help. If you're listening right now and you need this type of help, that's exactly what Chris is talking about. There's people there for you. Chris, the radar, the being able to know for the average person who sits next to that woman or that child, I mean, how do you, rather than just say someday, man, I always suspected.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, what's your radar? How do you know?
It's this is a really, really difficult area, right? And none of us are excellent at it. Again, kind of going back to that, your partner should make your flame burn brighter, right? So if I have a dear friend and this friend and I get together on a regular basis for coffee and they indicate that, you know, they have no control over their own finances, they're essentially on a curfew from their partner, they can't hang out with this person because their partner doesn't like that person. Like, those are all things that is not your partner allowing you to be the best you, right? If there's trust in the relationship, you know, I should be able to go where I want, spend what I want, hang out with who I want. No, I'm in a relationship. So that's, you know, my wife, Ashley, in this situation would obviously have say in that too, but she shouldn't control my life. And so if those are the kind of conversations that we're having with partners where it seems like, or friends where it seems like their partner has way too much control, that is the first indicator that something's
makes
really
sense.
Wrong. Yep. You know,
it really
so,
makes sense.
Yep. Like your partnership.
Right now, mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who have thought of a couple.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, they have.
Absolutely.
I've thought of a couple or two right now.
That's right.
Of what you said.
Right. No, I don't want to jump to a conclusion and violence in that home, but that's not a healthy dynamic, okay. Right? That's not a healthy dynamic. With children, that comes through in lots of different ways. We can see them go kind of different ends of the spectrum where they can get really, really withdrawn. To where they just seem like they're kind of in their own head. Or we might see children get very, very aggressive and act out. Those aren't the only two examples, but those are two of more common red flags, that a child gets very, very withdrawn, or this behavior kind of comes out of left field and looks just wildly destructive.
Yeah.
Yep. And
so, you know, we've got a situation where in North Dakota, it's been all over the media in regards to individual that was sex trafficking, being in jail, and who knows where that's going to lead. You and I both know that you know, there's been conversations about interaction with a legislator, those type of things. When is there some subculture out there that is way deeper and way broader than what a person really realizes? And I'm not trying to single out any one case as much as what I'm trying to say. If I found out that this was all happening in my backyard, I would go, really?
Yeah.
Whereas my suspicion is you wouldn't.
Yeah, no, we wouldn't. But keep in mind, we're pretty jaded. I mean, we see this every day, you know, so we might jump to the inaccurate conclusion too, right? I mean, because we just see so much of it. But in terms of child sexual abuse, far more prevalent than we realize. Child exploitation, sharing child pornography files.
Social media had to have hurt.
It's great. It's almost daily that you see a headline that someone regionally has been found with this material. I think human trafficking, you know, when Rape and Abuse Crisis Center first was getting our heads around what was the concept of human trafficking, one of our employees who had been there a while said, oh, right, we worked on this in the 70s when it was called forced prostitution. Which, you know, it's just been rebranded,
right.
You know, but we're very, very familiar with this issue. I think that happens far more prevalent than we realize. And then domestic violence is something that we still have not, as a society, gotten our arms around. And so these issues are very, very prevalent. And we believe that they're the underlying issue for a lot of other things that we're trying to treat in society.
So here's a question that came in for you. Says, please ask Dr. Johnson if he can comment on system failures, such as what happened leading to the death of the six-year-old boy in O'Connell, Minnesota, who died after being returned to his biological mother, who had major issues herself.
Yeah, this is a great question. It absolutely happens. And so, you know, we do see this where children are maybe, child welfare system, child protection has gotten involved, has done an evaluation, maybe prematurely has returned that child to the family, and then there's damage that happens, or in this case, or that case, death. I think it's people not explaining it away, but people need to recognize that with how prevalent these issues are, those child protection workers, and I have no inside information on this case specifically, mm-hmm. but those child protection workers may have spent a half an hour with the family because that's what they had. We see examples of this, you know, across the country that, you know, California has several examples of this too, where child protection services is just so overwhelmed that they're not able to do a thorough assessment. The other thing I want to say about that is we learned in the 40s and 50s that separating families is not a good idea. And so anytime Child Protective Services gets involved, even if we as the society think that that is a horrendous crime, their goal is to reunite the family. So that is their goal. Now, if we know that that child will be in imminent danger, of course, that's not the goal. But that is the overriding goal, that it makes more sense to keep families together than it does to split them apart.
Okay. So some of that surprises me.
Sure.
You know, and a lot of it is, if it's goal driven, then my guess is you need to get behavior in a place right. where you feel comfortable right. doing that, though.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And that's got to be hard to do with some people that are like, get out of my house.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we talked a little bit about the history of my career, my first job. You know, I had the opportunity to work for an organization that did courtesy foster care placements for the county. And you would take an 8-year-old child or 10, 12-year-old child and pick them up to bring them to foster care. And it might have been the most horrendous crime or the most horrendous example of child maltreatment that you've ever seen. Their first question is, when do I get to see my mom?
I bet.
You know,
that doesn't surprise me, I guess. But, you know, when you just take a step back and you here's the beautiful thing that I loved in my time in the legislature. People like you. Would come in and by being a nonprofit, and we talked about this on the phone, you can advocate without being managed by the government, for lack of a better way of putting it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're writing grants, you're involving yourself, and Department of Human Services and other people are working with you. This is no slam on the government. I just like people like you coming into a hearing room and laying it out there without having to have that filter of, okay, will the head of this department be okay with that?
Right.
And I think that information, I mean, Chris, that is so valuable to decision makers.
It, you know what, we really enjoy that opportunity when we get that opportunity to go in and provide education to the legislature. I know exactly what you're saying is, you know, I will be at times questioned or, you know, you can very much sense that there's a political charge that's kind of coming at me. And mm-hmm. you're right. I get to just completely overlook that. Like, I don't have a political agenda. I'm right. here to make health, right. Healthy and safe communities.
I don't work for a politician on right. either side of the aisle. Right. Basically, I'm in here working on behalf of those kids, that woman, that right. the people that are being raped and abused.
Right. And I you need know, you all to come with us. Right? Right. I need you all to join us.
Yeah, we need yeah. to all get in the boat. Right. We're rowing the same way.
Right.
I, you know, one of the high profile cases that I had read about and then I heard some more about this morning was a teenage girl at a Dallas Mavericks game that just went to the bathroom, never came back. And she was stolen. She was kidnapped. And, you know, the family went to the security guard and the security guard said, that's an issue for local police, not for us. And of course, things don't get locked down. That do you think, and they found her like, I want to say days, if not weeks later, in the hands of people that were sexually trafficking her. And that is every parent's, grandparent's worst nightmare.
Yeah, that's terrible.
And so do you think places like where the Mavericks were playing, for example, are ready to protect at times like that, because you can't watch them every minute.
Right, right. Especially in a crowded venue like that. I think that, you know, that does happen. That does happen, and we certainly see that. But what we know of children who are trafficked is the majority of the time, the overwhelming majority of the time, they're trafficked by someone who the family knows. This could be the parents themselves who are trafficking the children. Grandparents, aunts and uncles could be trafficking that children. A neighbor could be. Usually in a situation like that, there's a certain level of trust that is built that gives that adult access to that child. So we do see those abductions. We do see those. But most of the time when you're dealing with child human trafficking victims, it was someone that the child knew that pulled them into that life.
How often is drugs and alcohol involved?
You know, I think, you know, that could be a question just in general, right? I mean, right. We're a pretty heavy drugs and alcohol culture. And so, you know, we certainly see it. But we don't look at drugs and alcohol as a catalyst to these issues. We look at that and say, you know, like, let's look at someone who is on trial for domestic violence, and they're part of their defense is, well, I was drunk. And our thought is, well, right, but being drunk didn't create that power and control. Being drunk didn't green light the violence in your home. Like that might have made it a little bit less consequential in the moment, but this is part of who you are. Like, this is not the drugs and alcohol who are doing this to you. And
how often is the abuser a victim of abuse themselves?
That's another really good question. We know with child sexual abuse, we know that there is a correlation with that. You know, I think just looking at different generations, different generational ways of raising children, I think that, you know, if we went back 80 years, we would consider a lot of parenting child abuse. You know, so I do think that as a culture, we continue to move further and further away from kind of that corporal punishment, or, you know, that acceptance of being able to handle your partner, put hands on your partner. But I think that it's just as likely that we could look back at history and say we're just on a trajectory where we're kind of phasing this out of who we are as people. So I would say, in answer to your question, I think that is a factor, but I don't think it's a causal factor. I just think it's in play.
Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
I mean it. I mean, the world needs you and more of you. If people that are listening said, hey, you know, he just told me what was going on in my life, tell him what to do. Tell him where to go, what to do here.
Yeah, yeah. So if anyone is experiencing these issues, you know, there is domestic violence, there's sexual assault providers in your community. And so a quick Google search, you can call. There's national hotlines who can direct you towards an agency that's in your area. There's tons of information out there on the web. A good place to start is the Power and Control Wheel. That's something that DV agencies have used for over 40 years. Power and Control Wheel will just kind of lay out some of the dynamics that we see in violent relationships. And then always, 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 people can call Rape and Abuse Crisis Center. If we're not your provider, we will get you connected to your provider.
And never be afraid to call law enforcement.
Right. And another thing I want to say, Joel, that's really important is that I think part of what makes people suspicious of calling us is they're scared that we're going to put something in motion that they won't. We will absolutely not do that.
Yeah.
So unless it's a child abuse and neglect situation, we don't have an obligation to inform law enforcement. So if there's an adult in a relationship that's experiencing violence and you want to reach out and you're scared that we're going to get the police involved, we will not get the police involved unless that's what you want.
Okay.
And so I do think that's an important thing.
That is really important. Yeah. Because that actually surprised me. Yeah. So, you know, Dr. Johnson, thank you. Thanks for coming in, and hopefully we helped. And if you ever need to get word out, you know, call. I really believe that more conversations like this need to happen.
Thank you.